Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexity of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. If you have any comments you would like to make during this broadcast, you can feel free to email me at bonkay@aol.com, that's B-O-N-K-A-Y-E @aol.com. Before I introduce first my wonderful co-host for tonight and then my guest, I just wanted to remind people that the end of April we're having our annual healing weekend. It's going to be near Washington, D.C. It's going to be an amazing weekend with some amazing women as always, some what we call veterans and some people who are newer, who are just going through this beginning of their life. And one woman who I was speaking to the other day told me, well, she'll be coming there and she feels like a veteran. I said, you're not a veteran yet. You're only in your first year of healing. You know, it'll take a number of years before you become a veteran. But that's why there's no limit on healing, as we all know. So no matter what phase you're at, or where you are in your life, when you need support, it's wonderful to be in a room of women who know exactly everything you're talking about without even having to say a word. If you're interested in my healing weekend, you can go on my website at www.gayhusbands.com, and there's a link there to write to me. Or you can just write to me at bonkay@aol.com, and then the headline, Healing Weekend. And I will put you on the mailing list. All the information will be going out by the end of December. So before I even introduce my special guest tonight, I am so excited that I have my good friend and member of my support group, who's not member, leader in my support group, Deborah Sutton, joining us this evening. Deborah, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Bonnie?
Good. I'm so happy to talk to you.
I'm happy to talk to you too.
Good. And so how have you been, first of all? How are things in Texas?
Oh, things are good. We had our Thanksgiving family get-together yesterday. So I've been busy cooking and getting together with my family, and I've had a great time.
That's great. I know that this is the beginning of the holiday season, and so for many of our women, this is a really rough time. And starts at Thanksgiving, it ends in February after Valentine's Day, where there are loads of reminders about what we don't have and how women are going through this kind of trauma, many with post-traumatic stress, with different kinds of issues that are facing us during the holiday season. And my newsletter, which will be out, you know, the beginning of December, I'll have some tips for parents who have to do this. You know, maybe this is new in your life now that you're going through as a single parent. But now's a good time to find as much support as possible and to realize that no matter how many times we say make new traditions, easier said than done, that for some of our women it's a really tough time. So reach out for support. I will definitely be there. You can always write to me and I can hook you up with some wonderful members of our support network who are looking to reach out to you. And I know that I have a wonderful guest tonight who's coming back for a second time. I'd like to welcome back Dr. Ira Gelman. Ira, welcome back.
Hey, glad to be here.
Yes, and the last time you were here, you know, we had so many wonderful comments from women after you were on the show, appreciating you and what you shared with us as far as information. And just a little bit about Dr. Gelman, that he has his degree in psychology for the last 30 years. He has a PhD in human sexuality studies. He's a teacher now at college, and he also is a master in self-defense, which is really amazing to be a psychologist and be able to defend himself. And also, he teaches courses on psychology and human sexuality on the college level. So, Ira, how are you tonight? How was your holiday?
Hey, it was nice, busy. Actually, now I guess it's time to relax.
Well, that's good. I think we can all use that. So there are several different things we want to talk about tonight because, you know, we're so excited that you're here and that you do have so much expertise from your psychology on so many of these topics. So, Deborah, how would you like to ask the first couple of questions?
I would. I have a question, Ira. Can you tell us something about closeted gay men who marry women and use the wife and family in order to present a straight image? These men do lead double lives. Do they really believe they are straight?
You know, you can't give like a blanket answer because, you know, there are several types of men that we're talking about. I do believe there are some that do believe that they're not gay, that if they just have a gay encounter from time to time, that it's just fulfilling, you know, some need that they have an impulse. But then you do have other men who clearly know that they are gay and that the marriage, at least traditionally, was used as a cover, especially if there were children involved, because no one would ever suspect a married, you know, a heterosexually married man that had children as being gay. So I think we have like two different, you know, categories that, you know, of men that we're talking about.
I watched a video. It was put out by a gay man, and the gay community feels like they are being used by these types of closeted gay that will never admit they are gay. They feel like they're being used by this type of man as well. So is it that some of these men are just narcissists and don't care about gender? Any gender will do as long as they're getting narcissistic supply.
Yeah, I mean, the man who, the narcissist is someone who knows deep down inside that he's using the heterosexual relationship for his own needs. And the narcissist, and we need to realize that there's also what most people use as would use the term a sociopath. They're kind of similar, but there is a very big difference. The sociopathic behavior is a person that has absolutely no remorse and could not care less about anyone else's feelings or the damage that they've done. The narcissist is very manipulative and always wants to be the center of attention. But if they're ever called out on their deceitfulness, there will be some type of apologies that is genuine, where the antisocial person actually, so I don't confuse the listeners, if any of you use the internet to look up personality disorders, for decades...
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah, the DSM is called, the long name for it is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. That came out originally in the 1950s, and the goal was to have an objective criteria that would define different types of mental disorders. Because obviously there's a lot of subjectivity to diagnosing someone. It's not as if you just give a blood, you know, test and then you send it to the lab and you clearly know, you know, what disorder you have. When it comes to emotional disorders, there's subjectivity involved. So the DSM, as it's called in short, was developed by recognized experts in all different fields to help make diagnosing a disorder as objective as possible. And because this undertaking is just so involved and requires so many different experts, it only happens like once every 10 to 15 years where there's revisions that are made. So in 2013, I think it was, the DSM-5 was officially released. So if anybody goes to see a therapist, especially if insurance is involved, the insurance company will not cover the disorder unless it is diagnosed in the DSM. The DSM really doesn't tell you how to treat something, because in psychology there's different views on what caused the problem and how to go about managing it. It's strictly to classify and diagnose what mental disorders are. So for the first 4 decades of the DSM's existence, the term sociopath was used. But because there's a feeling that some titles of a disorder have a lot of baggage that may inhibit someone from seeking treatment, every once in a while the name of it is changed to sound less judgmental. For example, alcoholism is now called alcohol dependency. So to go back to what I said a few minutes ago, if anybody in the audience is going to look up sociopathic behavior, the new term that is used as of 2013 is called antisocial. So I don't want people to be confused, because most people would use the term antisocial to describe someone who's a loner. But if you're right, talking clinically, it now has a very different term. So for the rest of the evening, I'll use the term sociopathic behavior, since that's what I think most people okay. are used to. But if anyone goes to research it, just so they won't be confused, that there has been a name change.
Is it true that
thank you so much for clarifying that.
Is it true they're going to take these disorders like narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, out of the DSM? That's what I've been hearing.
You know, usually the people who say things aren't even involved in these teams that revise. So I don't want to act like I'm a know-it-all, but I don't see them going away anytime in the near future.
Okay.
But there are
Myra,
a lot of similarities between them. Yeah.
Yeah. When we talk about personality disorders, whether it be antisocial behavior, narcissism, realistically speaking, are these conditions that are learned behaviors, or are they born behaviors? Is it nature versus nurture? What's the story with that?
You know, you could ask, you know, 6-7 different experts, and you'll probably get, like, 2 major answers. It's the consensus from people that I talk with in the field is that obviously someone's upbringing has a major impact on their personality. But when you look at how many siblings have the same upbringing and don't turn out like the sociopath or the narcissist, the other question then comes into, well, is there something genetic that could be there that presents itself in a certain type of environment? So to say, you know, it's conclusive that something is strictly the environment, I don't think is really a good answer, because anybody who's ever, you know, had children knows that you can tell from birth there's a certain temperament that we're born with, and that came before the environment. You know, that is something that came, you know, in our DNA.
Right. So let's say assume that it is either learned. Well, I guess there's a big difference, because if it is something that's inherited, does that mean that it can change or not?
I don't know if the person could change, but if the person, you know, it's kind of like someone who's an alcoholic. My belief is, can an alcoholic ever be taught to drink responsibly? Without question, the answer is no. I think a lot of people get misdiagnosed with alcoholism, and they claim that they now can, you know, drink responsibly. But my point is that if you are an alcoholic, you can certainly learn to treat your disease or your condition by abstaining from alcohol. You're still an alcoholic, but you're not active in your addiction. So going back to someone who's a narcissist, if the person truly believes that they are and they're going for help, I believe that they can learn to manage their narcissism. And with really intensive therapy, kind of reorganize how they relate to the world and their family. But that takes an awful lot of therapy that most people probably would not want to invest, you know, the time into. So nothing is set in stone, but there has to be an honest desire. And typically, you know, if you were talking about like a gay man that was keeping his homosexuality a secret, it's like someone having an affair. You know, they may act hysterical and cry, but are they crying because they got caught, or are they genuinely sorry? And I think a lot of it is that they got caught. If they were genuinely, you know, hysterical, then why didn't they tap into those feelings before they strayed? So in that case, if the person is doing it, you know, just to try to look like they're making amends, then the therapy is not going to work at all.
But with somebody who has an antisocial behavior, I mean, I think they're on a totally different brain wave of what's right and what's wrong, and they really can't differentiate necessarily. So I don't know if they'd ever even be able to change anything, because they don't think they're wrong on anything to start with. I don't think therapy will ever help that, do you?
Well, you know, like any disorder, you have a mild, moderate, or severe level. So, you know, for example, you know, it's not always black or white. I am sure a lot of us have maybe looked someone in the eye like a friend and totally lied to them. Now, when you look someone in the eye and you lie to them, like for those people that take pride in being a good liar, please don't say that again, because that's like saying you're a good sociopath. Mm-hmm. Because you're not showing any signs at all of sorrow, or, you know, especially if you don't hesitate. So you're proud of yourself. And you know, when I teach and kids tell me, or students tell me that, you know, they really did something, but, you know, the assignment was left at home, I'll say, hey, look, if you're straight with me, that's not a problem. And some of them are, and then some of them will just say it to get away with it, to use maybe, you know, my sense of trust in them. But for those who do it convincingly, they have a much bigger issue than not having their work in, and that would be it's getting easier for them to lie.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get more bold in their lies and more convincing.
Can you talk a little bit about what Deborah was bringing out before? If someone is leading a lie on a daily basis, like many of these gay husbands do, because, you know, I personally could never imagine having to hide my sexuality day in and day out. And it's so painful for women. And, you know, one woman I spoke to this week, I really started crying, you know, because she said to me that she kept saying to herself, why can't I be a better wife? Why? What am I doing wrong? And she kept questioning herself over and over and over again why her husband couldn't feel this sense of intimacy for her. She went for therapy to see how she could be a better wife. And I think about all the women who spend years in therapy for something that they have no clue about because they're living with someone who's dishonest. And, you know, it's one thing, like I said, there's all different levels of dishonesty, but your sexuality in a marriage, it's a really big gap there. So do you think that when you lie on a daily basis, does this create this kind of behavior?
Yeah, the longer...
It becomes inherent that you can just lie so easily?
Yeah, the longer, you know, you get away with this type of behavior, just the easier it becomes. It's like how many times, you know, have all of us sworn, you know, we're not going to do something again, and then, of course, you know, we still do it again. And then when we don't really have to pay a big price, we just keep going. You know, it could be something like running, a light when it's turning, you know, yellow. It's not all that often there's a cop there. And then what happens, you know, eventually, you know, a cop, you know, sees what we did. And then we get pulled over. And then we tell ourselves we'll never do it again. And then as the weeks turn into a couple of months, you know, we're in a rush and we're like, oh, what the heck? And we go through the light. And then after you do it a couple of times, that lack of discipline now makes it easier to continue.
It's no big deal anymore.
No. And then someone who's, you combine that now with a narcissist, they're going to believe that you are persecuting them.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of them taking responsibility for running the yellow light, they're saying, you know, oh, you know, you're there looking for me. So for the gay man who is lying to his wife constantly, he's going to get very defensive, and if she does ask him any questions about what's going on, he's going to try to make it look like she has the problem. And that kind
that's
of manipulative
exactly
behavior, yeah, that type of manipulative behavior is very destructive for the self-esteem of the woman.
So could you talk a little bit also about passive-aggressive behavior and explain that to our listeners?
Well, if you think how most of us express our needs and desires or something, you know, our boundaries, we typically get that from our family of origin. So for those people that grew up in a household where they witness people having a constructive argument, a constructive discussion, we develop those skills. But for those people that have witnessed only destructive behavior, they don't know any better. So in a passive-aggressive person, they typically are not going to yell and scream at you, but they're unable. And I do believe it's really unable, as opposed to just unwilling, to express what is bothering them because they don't know how to. And if they grew up in a volatile household, they're now trying to avoid any type of anger that will happen. So in their mind, they're kind of like covering their anger by being passive, like, you know, when it's obvious something is wrong, they'll say, like, nothing. You know, their tone of voice is giving it away. Or if you ask, you know, could I help you? even if they want it. You know, in these types of cases, whether you ask or don't ask, it's like you're darned if you do and you're darned if you don't. They're not able to tell you what they need because they themselves probably don't feel like it's okay for them to express it. And when someone has done this for years and decades, they're unaware that they're doing it.
So can that be defined and changed?
If a person really wants to. You know, if somebody recognizes that they are passive-aggressive, then they need to, they can change, but it's going to take a lot of time and effort. And I think a lot of people, you know, when they get motivated to change, there was something, like, very powerful that happened that's motivating them. But like anything else in life, as that powerful experience, you know, turns into days or weeks, it loses its intensity. And then the person's motivation goes down.
Ira, just to change the subject for a moment, because Deborah and I often discuss this particular issue, so maybe you could give us some insight on it. Right now, in the news, it's very obvious to all of us that the whole issue of sexual harassment has become a major issue facing society today. And with so many public people or celebrities or news people being accused now by women of inappropriate sexual behavior, and now that it's coming out in the open, it's everywhere you go, people who are very respectable figures that you find out were not nearly as respectable as they were, you know, proclaiming to be. And it's a horrifying situation to see the humiliation and embarrassment that women and men also had to go through, because some of these people, as Deborah mentioned, when you're a narcissist, you don't necessarily have to be gay to be with a man. You know, you just go with anybody. But here's one thing that we were always wondering about, because I don't understand this concept, and Deborah and I have a hard time with this. We've read articles about men who are being raped by women, and I just don't grasp on to that as well. So are you familiar with that situation?
I mean, I've heard of it. You know, we live in a culture now where, you know, the term PC is very powerful, you know, political correctness.
Uh-huh.
And it seems, you know, like when people talk about eating disorders, they say, you know, it affects men. Well, of course it does. But 90% or so of people with eating disorders are female. So obviously men are, you know, the other 10%, but to make it sound like it's anywhere near equal is absolutely ridiculous and does a disservice to the topic. So when it comes to, you know, sexual harassment, you know, the PC culture that is talking about men being raped by women, I mean, the case that I hear about would be someone, you know, a guy who is drunk and then wakes up, you know, next to a woman and, you know, undressed of some state or maybe totally, and doesn't have any idea if she had sex with him. Now, there are cases like that that do happen, but the big difference is, which is not a very PC thing to say, which I'm going to say anyway, is that a guy does not feel, you know, typically violated and have to go through, you know, for therapy over this. If anything, if the truth be told, a lot of guys would be like, well, you know, maybe that's a sign that I'm desirable and that's why she wanted me. So the dynamics there are very different than when a woman is violated.
Well,
so just
that's
the term
Deborah
rape.
And I, right, Deb?
Yeah, just the yeah, I'm sorry.
No, okay. Do you agree, Deb?
Oh, I agree with everything Ira said.
But I could tell you, like, when I went through my doctoral program in human sexuality, I mean, I am talking about the premier university in the United States for human sexuality. Everything really was PC. So the statement that I just said, I would probably, if I was back in the program, have gotten into an awful lot of trouble, because I was somehow saying that there was a difference in a man that gets sexually assaulted versus a woman. Now, I'm going to say, okay, I'm past the point of really worrying about stuff like that. But if we're trying to do a real service and talk about a topic like sexual harassment, one of the worst things to do is to try to equate that what happens to a woman and what happens to a man is the exact same. And it's like one of the most ridiculous conversations I ever had in my life was when I was dealing with these ultra-liberal feminists that were saying that female genital mutilation was the same thing as male circumcision. And I'm talking other doctoral students at the time, very intelligent people. So This political correctness of trying to equate everything has gone to the extreme, and it's hurting many conversations.
Well, because there's a movement out there, and it's really interesting, of men who claim that they were raped by women and how it's traumatized them for years and years and years. And I just find it's hard to believe for me.
I don't believe it. I think these men are liars or they're getting paid, and that's another thing. We don't realize how many people, you know, actually get paid, whether it's political rallies or these type of discussions. And the media, you know, fuels the fire because they're looking for these outliers, you know, that they can showcase as their so-called proof, you know, that this phenomenon exists. So I don't buy it.
I try to comprehend it. It's just, you know, and I just heard another story about it. Someone sent me the story, one of our members, you know, just the other day. It was in the news again. And, you know, about another man being raped. And he woke up, like you said, and he didn't have his clothes on. He didn't exactly remember it. But, you know, he knows that he was violated. But I just have a heart. And like I said, this other guy we're talking about, he has a whole campaign for all these years, you know, going on all these radio shows and letting
like 30
men,
years.
People, you know, 30 years he can't get past this.
He's doing
like
it just
really
to get
strange.
His name out there or to get on, or to maybe he's a narcissist and this is how he's getting his like 15 minutes of fame. It's ridiculous. How did he even know, you know, that he was violated? It's the whole thing I think is absolutely insane. And it's shameful because it does distract from like the real issues.
That's how we feel, too, but we thought, you know, we don't know enough. I'm really glad you confirmed that for us. Right, Deborah?
Yes. I wanted to ask Ira if he could tell us something about codependency and why it seems that I was codependent and feel like I was a, you know, like easy prey for this type of man. Abusive type and someone that lied about his sexuality. So you could explain codependency. I know not every woman in our situation is codependent, and some were brought up in loving households, but for some of us that's not the case.
I know I'm still on the line because I didn't hear anything click like. Guys, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay, but the last, like, 2 or 3 minutes, I didn't hear anything. The last thing I heard was Deborah say something about codependency.
Yeah, I wanted you to talk to us about codependency.
Yeah, my thoughts on that is that is like 99% of a person's, you know, environment, how they may have been raised feeling lacking a high degree of self-confidence, and so they gain all of their perceptions of themselves through someone who they are attached with. And I am a big believer that a lot of us on a very subconscious level look for romantic figures in our life that somehow remind us of an unresolved conflict that we have had with a parent. So for people that grew up with unresolved conflicts, they don't realize how lucky they were, they find people that, you know, treat them well and have healthy relationships. But for those that have a lot of unresolved conflicts, especially if it is with one parent, I believe that nothing happens by accident, that they pick relationships without realizing it, that somehow bring them back to that time of growing up where they did not feel they were accepted. So if this person they're with somehow it does accept them, it is very calming to them and almost brings them back to, you know, solving their problems that was unresolved with whichever parent they had the conflict with. So in this case, if we're talking about a woman who's codependent on her husband, she's looking at him as giving her value. So in a lot of these marriages where gay men marry heterosexually, the sex life is not all that great. There's long periods of time where there may have been very little sexual contact. And these women internalize that as that they're undesirable. And they are striving, instead of looking that maybe there's something wrong with the person they're with, they do the opposite. And they blame themselves for the lack of intimacy because they are so dependent on the affection of the man that they're with. That's not capable of returning what they're looking for. And then if you combine that with someone who grew up in a household that sexually was very restrictive, it's not even on their radar screen that they could be married to somebody who is actually gay.
Oh, that was a very good explanation.
Yeah, I wanted to know also your opinion, Ira. If someone comes from a family where there is dysfunction, which in today's society is not unusual, because you have people coming from homes where there's mental illness, alcoholism, drug addiction, so many different issues that I'm sure they were there when we were growing up, but we just didn't see them as visibly. But if you come from a home where there's dysfunction, I find that a lot of times women walk into dysfunctional relationships because to them, that's what their norm is. They haven't seen really any other kind of behavior. So they're willing to stay in a destructive type of relationship longer than somebody who might come from a positive environment.
I'll go one step further. They don't just stay in it. They seek it. These are women that if they met a nice guy that treated them with respect, they wouldn't know what to do with it. They would feel uncomfortable. They probably would say it's boring, but what they really mean is that they don't feel like they're worth being treated properly. So their script is to be treated with a lack of respect. And then let's not forget some biology I'll throw in here. Dopamine is the feel-good neurotransmitter that we have. So every time the person that we're with does show us some forgiveness or, you know, that shows us if they ever said they were sorry for something or shows us some positivity, we get that dopamine drip and we're like, wow, you know, this really is fantastic. And those kinds of relationships, you can see they're like roller coasters. There's very little middle ground. It's either you're sky high or you are, you know, very far down below.
And it's usually very far down below, right?
Yeah, and the further down below you are, when there is a little bit of kindness that's shown, you know, it feels like it's a great amount because everything in life, you know, is relative. Because relative to that situation, the little bit of kindness or attention feels like, you know, $1 million to the person.
Can a codependent person work on healing and, you know, find her value and self-worth and be able to be in a relationship with someone that treats her well without feeling,
you know,
like,
without question, but I go back to the person really has to want it. And we are amazed. I'm always amazed at how we create reality for ourselves, no matter how ridiculous it is. And I see this all the time with, like, teenage girls, where they'll be with these guys who treat them like dirt, and then usually the guy is the one to walk out on them. And then when the guy calls them back for a quickie or for maybe things weren't as great as he expected, they just fall right back into the same patterns that they did before they were dumped. So the codependents can learn, but unfortunately, they tend, you know, you heard about hitting rock bottom, they tend to have to go through tremendous amounts of humiliation and loneliness before they finally become strong enough to say, I'm done. And that's a shame. That, I think, is a crying shame, that somebody feels or has to go so low in their life before they can finally see some daylight.
Yeah,
I think if you combine
this,
that also with some domestic violence thrown in, that just keeps the kettle flaming even longer. You know, a lot of times women do want to stand up for themselves, but they're knocked down physically or so badly emotionally. A lot of our women are very emotionally battered. And believe me, you knew me during a time when I was very emotionally battered down. So I have very strong sympathy for women who, I was a very strong woman who was able to get knocked down after being battered emotionally. So I know women who weren't nearly as strong as, you know, I was, are also very vulnerable and can get knocked down further. And a lot of times when there's domestic violence, which I was not a victim of, but some of our women are, and you're so scared to do any kind of move because you're going to get hit or you're going to get punched, I mean, it's very frightening to think, you know, about that road to recovery.
I think when...
Debbie, you were going to say something?
Yeah, when... what you were talking about, being abused physically and verbally, trauma bond occurs, like Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, I mean, I have spoken to women who were physically abused that will look you in the eye and say that they still love their husband. And I believe them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they just have come to accept it that from time to time, you know, they're going to get hit. And how do you treat someone like that? Well, you can't, because they are accepting of the situation. It's only when a person has gotten to the point where I don't even want to say they had to go to the hospital, because they probably have had to gone or should have gone, you know, many times before. But when something becomes maybe life-threatening to them, that they finally, you know, do something. But in many cases, maybe because the woman doesn't feel like she has a support system, you know, I don't know if her dad is involved, if she has a brother who's involved, that she feels, you know, can help her stand up to an abusive husband. You know, court systems today are courthouses. When you go through them, many of them now have metal detectors, and people tend to think that's because of maybe organized crime. Not true. It was found maybe 15, 20 years ago that there was a very high percentage of women that were either shot or knifed by their estranged husband or boyfriend right on, you know, the courthouse property. And
wow.
Someone may say, well, that doesn't make sense because these men are going to get caught. They didn't care. Either they would commit suicide, or they were just so irrational in their hatred that it didn't matter to them if they did get caught. So that's why courthouses today have metal detectors. It has nothing to do with regular crime. It has to do about domestic abuse.
What is an obsession with, like when men are obsessed with women, what category does that fall under, where they would go to the extreme to be doing something like that?
Like OJ and...
You know what,
right.
You're talking about men whose only way of getting self-confidence is to have, you know, people look up to them. So it could be something like a borderline personality disorder. And for the audience, if you've never heard that before, borderline personality disorder is the name of a disorder. It's not an adjective to describe somebody, you know, in between things. It's actually the name of a disorder. And borderline personality disorders have a very unstable self-image of themselves. And they have a very deep need or fear of abandonment. No matter how popular they are, it doesn't matter that it was someone like O.J. Simpson. If someone has a fear of abandonment, that could drive them to extreme violence if they feel they're going to lose that connection to someone.
Now, would that also be a form of antisocial behavior?
It could be. You know, a lot of these have similarities to them. But when you talk more about, you know, the violence there, and the separation anxiety, that like is leaning more towards the borderline than it is towards the antisocial.
But they all have narcissism, don't they? These personality disorders, like the antisocial and the borderline.
Yeah, because they're not. I mean, a narcissist, they need admiration. Like they're the ones who, in a conversation, they're the ones who want the center of attention to be on them. So no matter, like, what you say, I remember my first year of teaching, I was having lunch with a group of other educators, and this one teacher, it just seemed like she kept playing this one-upsmanship. And then when she found out that I was a big wrestling fan of college and high school, she said that she went out with the state champion when she was in high school. And I just looked at her like, there's one state champion and you went out with him. It was just like, whatever you said, you went on a vacation to some locale, you know, she would pick some place that was just, you know, even nicer. And she was a very popular person. A lot of times, you know, we don't realize that someone who is a narcissist or antisocial or borderline, they could be very attractive looking, typically charismatic people. So there's definitely similarities here, but the borderline is the one that tends to, you know, be the more violent of these groups. A serial killer, though, like that would be more of the antisocial. You know, someone in a personal relationship that was violent, I would categorize in borderline. Someone who went out, you know, to like when I grew up in the Bronx, and my this is an infamous, you know, type of claim here, and he was a lot older than me, so I never knew him. But if the audience ever heard of the Son of Sam, he actually went to the same high school that I went to. And that type of violence, that would be more antisocial, because now he's not looking at a person as a living, feeling thing or a living, feeling being or just a thing. Where the borderline is not going to be a serial killer. But if they feel that the person that they're attaching themselves with isn't going to admire them and be with them, then their attitude is, well, if I can't have you, nobody will. And that's where the violence comes in.
And it does. And we see that over and over again. And not to make it all one-sided, we know, Deborah and I both know, that there are women who are narcissists. You know, it's not just the male disorder. You know, we've met some of them, and some of our women who are narcissists.
And any one of us that has a friend that, let's just say, is the friend where you don't even want to ask them how things are anymore because it always seems like there's another tragedy in their life, that's narcissistic behavior, because the conversation is always on them. They never ask you how you are or if they can be there for you. They just want you to be there for them. So the drama queens and kings definitely fall under narcissistic behavior.
Well, one thing I'll tend to disagree with you on with that, Ira, they do ask you how you are. They just don't need
it. But do
an
they
answer.
Need it though? Yeah, they yeah.
They just don't care.
Yeah, I know.
Get away
agree
for
on
the
that.
Answer.
Yeah. If they have good social
that's
skills,
how they get
right?
The conversation. How are you? By the way, before you can even answer, they're already on
yeah.
the phone.
Right? Yeah. True.
Yes, I had one like that before. So, you know, all of these interesting behaviors, you know, really play into many of the marriages that we have. So, I guess this is the issue I'd like for you to discuss. While we still have some time, I tell our women that when you go into these marriages, either you are vulnerable, you know, you're coming out of a situation, maybe it's a bad home, maybe it was dysfunction, and even if you had a good home, while you're living in this mess of dysfunction, you have to really evaluate, you know, your situation when you leave it, because if you jump too fast, you're going to find yourself in another relationship that's destructive. And I'm not necessarily talking about a gay man, but some kind of man, but a man who has some kind of personality disorder, because from my point of view and my perspective, from everything I've seen over 35 years, that they are men who are waiting for women like us, who are kind, who are vulnerable, and they know us, they can sniff us out, and that's who they aim for. And if you're not strong enough to recognize it or to stop it before it goes on, you're going to find yourself in another trap. Do you agree with that?
Oh, without question. I mean, the most vulnerable a person is when they're on the rebound, because they're already so low that
uh-huh.
any type of kindness that comes their way is magnified in their eyes, you know, 100%.
Uh-huh.
And anyone who is looking, you know, for their happiness based on someone saving them, you need to get therapy pretty quickly, because you got to first count on yourself before you, you know, you look for someone else. Because anybody who's healthy themselves, they're not looking for people to save. And I know of people like this. He's not really a friend. He's more of an acquaintance. It just seems like every person, every woman he goes out with, like one is like more, has more issues than the one before. And it's not a coincidence. The guy's a handsome guy. He's making decent money.
Uh-huh.
But he gets his self-value from finding people that he can help. And I don't ever
you
see
know,
him being.
It's been him, right, that needs that kind of. He's
yeah,
lacking
yeah.
something that he wants to feel better.
Yeah, from what I know,
character.
It would be definitely his upbringing. You know, the lack of affection that he got, I believe, is now causing him, you know, to form relationships like this.
Uh-huh. So that's why it is so important that you have to recognize that if you've been in a destructive relationship of any kind, and some of our women were in destructive relationships before their gay husband, so... It kind of looked good compared to what they had. And you see, you can't go through life just comparing, you know, one horrible thing to another horrible thing. You have to get beyond that. And that's why sometimes therapy is very important when you're in that situation, more so than even support, because if that's your issue, you need to work it through so that you can find the happiness that you're looking for. Deborah,
oh,
do you
without
have anything
question.
Else you want to ask before we run out of time?
I mean, I could tell you just a quick one on that. Someone that
uh-huh.
I was talking with who is in an abusive relationship until the guy finally walked out on her because he was cheating on her, and then he left her for someone else. When she was asked, and she was divorced, why did you allow this to go on for so long? Her answer was, at least this one didn't beat me. And that totally,
uh-huh.
you know, says exactly what you did in comparison to what she lived with. And her husband was, and by the way, she didn't leave her husband. He had also left her for someone else.
Huh.
So unfortunately,
really scary
if, yeah, it is scary. If someone goes into a relationship where they have very little self-esteem, their chance of having a healthy relationship and outcome, unfortunately, is very low.
So,
Deborah, did you have anything else you wanted to do?
I just wanted to say that it needs to be about, instead of the gay husband or the narcissist, it needs to, we need to reach this point where it's about us and our own healing, you know, so that we don't get into these kind of relationships again.
Oh, I certainly would agree there.
Yes, and healing is a process. It's not just something. I have women who tell me, well, you know, I'm over it now. It's been 3 months. No, you're not over it, and 3 months doesn't make a healed person. You don't become whole in 3 months, no matter how much you think you are. You know, there's a lot of residual scarring that will hit you in the face when you least expect it. And a lot of times women who just jump into new relationships, I haven't seen one yet that's really worked out, not one, where somebody meets someone and immediately they're in love, they're in lust, they're whatever the case is, and they're ready to go again and to put the past behind them and to start a new future, and all within a few weeks or a few months. That's just not happening. You know, you're missing signs, you're not looking at red flags, right?
Yeah, I mean, earlier I had said to you, I'm always amazed at how people create their own realities, and no matter what life experience certain people have had, they still have this warped sense of what will be, and they try to force it, you know, and then project it onto the next relationship.
And I think during this holiday season, people are much more vulnerable because we have a lot of women in our network. This is their first year alone. You know, they've been married for 10, 15, 20, 30 years, and their marriage fell apart this year. And now, you know, they're facing family holidays, you know, which all of these holidays, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's or Valentine's Day, these are all geared towards love, family, happiness. And they're not feeling it or having it. And so they may think they're going to find so easily somewhere else. And don't trick yourself. Don't fool yourself. You know, you can get through this holiday season. You don't have to keep, you know, not going to be easy, and you don't have to feel bad if you feel unhappy. I think we all go through that, and there's nothing bad to feel about feeling bad during a time like this. Would you agree with that, Ira?
100%. You know, that's where, you know, a lot of us, you know, we lead these Walt Disney lives, you know, where we expect the prince to be waiting outside, you know, with the glass slipper. Maybe that works in a movie, but the reality is you're right. There are times where you're going to feel like crap, you're not going to be happy, you're going to cry, and that's just part of the managing and healing process. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Right, because the end of a marriage or the death of the marriage is like grieving anything else. You know, when you lose someone you love, for whatever the reason is, it's a grieving period, so you can't be surprised. And I tell our women, if you need support, we have it available for you. Just write to me at bondk@aol.com, and I'll be happy to set that up for you. Deborah, it's been a wonderful hour with Ira, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. It's been great.
Well, my pleasure,
lady.
You're
really wonderful in explaining, and we hope you'll come back here soon again in the next few months, because
definitely,
there's still so many more issues that we have to talk about.
What? So next few months? You don't want me back sooner?
Yeah, I do. I didn't want to get greedy. I do, but I hate to press the issue, but I'd love to have you come back sooner.
All right. Well, you guys have a great holiday, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you so much, Ira.
Merry Christmas.
Okay. All right. Good night.
Okay,
bye.
Good night. And Deborah, thank you so much for co-hosting tonight.
Thank you for having me.
I felt so much more at ease with you here, and I hope you'll do it again and again.
Yes.
And again.
Yes,
that would be wonderful. And Deborah's going to be our guest. Deborah will be our guest in 2 weeks. So we're going to be talking about her book and the lessons that Deborah can teach us, and her blogs, and how active she is in helping others and reaching out. Because when you need a friend, Deborah's the person you go to. I sure know I go to you, Deborah. And you know I love you.
And I love you too.
Thank you. And to all of our ladies, have a good week. We know it's a tough time, but we're here for you. So we'll be back again next week. And until then, good night to everyone. Good night, Deborah. I love you.
Good night.
All right. Good night.